I'm Justine. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Justine.
One of our own. Doesn't it feel good? You belong someplace. I didn't belong anywhere when I first came here, and I did not feel welcome. I mean, I knew you welcomed me, but I just didn't know what I was getting myself into. My sobriety date is March 16th, 1983. I have a sponsor. Her name is Mary D., and I sponsor women, and I try to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I say that because sometimes I'm successful and sometimes I'm not. The only one I'm responsible for is my own recovery. And a little telltale, as I called Mary D. today, who is now 86 years old, and Mary D. is, she has been in my life for over 30 years. And she is now dealing with the death of her daughter, and she is beginning to have dementia, and it is heart-wrenching for me. And so I have had to begin the process of segue into allowing another woman to know me, to recognize my patterns. And the reason a sponsor is so important in my life now is that I have to rely on their thinking because my thinking is whacked. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll give you a little idea of when I came in here. I did not know I was mentally, physically, and spiritually bankrupt. I now know that. I just didn't know what those feelings felt like. I didn't know why I felt so so empty. And then they gave those words like, you know, bewilderment and frustrated and desperate. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, they know. When I first walked into my first meeting, I thought they planted the speaker. I'm thinking, oh, my God, my brother told them I was coming. And they were speaking the language that I couldn't even face myself. And yet when they spoke, this, you know, couple speakers, they I understood them for the first time. It was the language of the heart, and we have a book about that. You know, let me just start by qualifying myself. I was one of six children, and I was the fifth one, and they were all alcoholics. So by the time they got to number five, my parents were well-versed in Al-Anon. And it was a good thing, and it wasn't a good thing, you know, because you couldn't manipulate them. And I believe to this day that my sobriety was contingent on the fact that I knew there was no way out, that that all the conniving and the manipulating, it wasn't my fault. They worked for the first three. The fourth one, they figured it out, and by the fifth one, they're like, there's the door. And I knew that, and I think it helped me come to terms with the fact that this was a deadly disease, even though I thought I had more time. And yet at the same time, I was done. My actual sobriety date falls on my birthday. And the reason it falls on my birthday is that I'm pretty Irish, and March 16th is just before St. Patrick's Day, and there were many, many, many St. Patrick's Day I don't remember. And I was getting ready for one of those tear drunks, because I deserved it, and that I hadn't really had, you know, hadn't been drinking, because I was proven that I wasn't an alcoholic, and I could feel the angst. I could feel myself getting excited about this weekend, and I could feel the plans coming together, like, really, this is going to be a rip-roaring one. And then all of a sudden, it dawned on me that if I go out, I may not live to see that following day. And that was my moment of truth. And I'm going to put it in context, because there was things that led up to that, and it was really, I almost feel gypped now that if that was it, I wish I at least got one drink out of the deal, but I didn't. It was the what was about to happen based on what had happened in the past. I was a weird kid, so if you can picture this, my parents dealing with the older ones drinking and the police coming and the alcoholism, I was the quiet one that was pulling the chair up into the cabinet and taking the vanilla out, some like 5 years old, you know, licking the vanilla in the cabinet while, you know, sniffing the magic markers, you know, so I've got like black marks on my nose, drinking this, and they're dealing with police and broken windows, and I'm thinking if they had a rehab, I was 5 years old, I probably could have gone, you know, and that's how young it was. And did anyone tell me that, you know, vanilla was alcohol? No. So I can't even give credit to the fact that I knew I was drinking. I just went like a magnet right up to that counter, and there was something in that little brown bottle that I liked the taste of it. And I remember like my mother picking me up and you're like, get out of here, go. And I'm thinking, that cabinet had a draw to it. And my parents didn't have a lot of alcohol around, so to me that was the liquor cabinet, the baking cabinet. So, and then I'm thinking when I got into school, I'm always sniffing magic markers. So I used to have black mark all the time. Like, who does that? Where did that come from? But I didn't know that. You know, that huffing must have done something to my mind, and the teacher sounded a lot better. And that's how I started childhood. And I'm thinking there had to have been some correlation to this natural desire to look for something that was not inside. I was also very shy and very frightened. You know, I was like one of those frightened kids. I remember, you know, standing in line in the Catholic school, and I happened to be the first one in line, but I was tall, so it was unusual that I wasn't in the back. And I remember her like screaming and thinking she was screaming at me when she really never was. She just, that was her natural voice. And I was petrified. And at that moment, behind her was this, you know, ominous statue of God, and pretty much that was my, you know, fear of God. I remember it like it was yesterday, and all I had to do was like listen to her voice, and I was paralyzed in my seat. And so this loving God did not exist in my world. It was a fearful, afraid, and punishing. And if I didn't get it from her words, I was one that was hit often in school. And so between her being tall and you know, a large woman and the statues behind her, I'm thinking, I'll never make it to second grade. You know, I'm a goner. And yet I was afraid at a very young age to break any rules. So I got clever at breaking them. You know, I didn't want to get caught is what the real fear was. And so that was where alcoholism was inside me, meaning fear-driven, no sense of a loving God, and that there's some escape somewhere. And so I start out in my world, and my first people-pleasing was a girl in my class. Her name was Jill Dempsey, and her father was a police sergeant. And I wanted her to invite me to her birthday party, and I wanted her to like me. And I knew that she wasn't allowed to play with me. And the reason she wasn't allowed to play with me is her father was arresting my brothers on a regular basis. And I didn't know that. I just knew that it was shame and guilt. But I also wanted her to like me. So I kept going back for a door that was closed. And again, set up a pattern that I recognized in my four step. And, you know, that whole, if I can't have it, I only want it more, you know. So it became an obsession. So I'm now in fourth grade with an obsessive behavior. I want you to like me. What do I have to do? And that whole chameleon piece of me came out. You know, if I brought you, you know, something from cookies, or I, you know, gave you my lunch, or I did whatever, that part came out, and that's as far back as I could actually pinpoint it. And where I stop it is in my daily reprieve today, is where am I pleasing God and not people? You know, where am I of service to God and not trying to bring cookies for the wrong reasons? You know, it's where is my who and what I am, you know? And these were some of the things I had to uncover, because what was going to come was a snowball effect, this personality, because I haven't even picked up a drink yet. So you know, I'm in my world, and as my parents are getting older and dealing with alcoholism, the freedom, I've been given much more freedom than a lot of my friends. So my my group shifted. All of a sudden, I wanted to hang with the kids who, you know, parents didn't ask where they were. And, you know, I picked up my first drink, my first cigarette, and, you know, a substance other than alcohol all in the same weekend. And I'm thinking, I found life. You know, like, man, I was 16 and I thought I had arrived. You know, I could dance better. I could talk better. I didn't care if she liked me anymore. You know, it was one of those things where everything just kind of got put together. And I'm like, I like this. Right off the bat, it, you know, Friday night, Saturday night, my first drunk, I got sick, and I was so sick. And as soon as I could, you know, wipe my face and the room stopped spinning, I'm like, let's do that again. That was so much fun. And try it again. You know, let's party until you drop was our motto, and immediate. So I started hanging right away, and I blacked out right away, but I didn't know other people didn't. I just thought that was part of the gig, and I was a blackout a person, and I would wake up, and usually I had some good sense of where that last drink was, because I, you know, for the, at least during high school, I was always in a place that was safe, you know, a girlfriend's house, and just, you know, haha, we tell stories, and I really wouldn't believe that I really did that, but they laugh, so therefore, you know, this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde was, they would say sometimes I was hilarious and other times I was mean, and I'm thinking, I really said that to that person? And they said, oh yeah, it was great. You stood right up for all of us. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I actually did it. So it gave me that false courage, but there was a part of me that wasn't pleased with me, but because they liked it, it was all right. You know, like, oh, okay. You know, and learning who I was became a mystery. I started losing, who am I? You know, who is the person underneath this core? So I began to start taking the things, you know, I was an athlete, but I wasn't great. But if I made, you know, the varsity team and played most of the game, that was okay. I was also on part of the high school drinking team. I wasn't the best, but I was enough to, you know, keep up with the heavy hitters. Debating. I was so shy, I found out that if I drank before a tournament, I could win trophies. And I started learning how to have shields. So the field hockey coach loved the fact that I was also on the drama team, so that I'm like, oh my God, I got away with murder, cutting classes, telling them I was there. And so I started realizing that it really wasn't a lie, that it was just, you know, we didn't, a lot of omission started to happen. And the false beliefs. The sad part is I started to believe my own lies, and they talk about the delusion in this big book. So I'm beginning to, you know, I accomplish a lot because I'm riding this wave that's a fake wave, but I'm afraid to let it crash because it's working. And it worked until I got into college, and all of a sudden the work level increased. The scholarship I got to do crewing right here in school in D.C., it kind of interfered with my drinking. I really wasn't in from the night before, so to get up and start crewing at 5 in the morning when you finish drinking at 4:30 was getting a little rough. So I let that go, and so with the scholarships, my grades started to slip. And the bottom line was that I really only drank for 6 years. And in that period of time, when they talk about that dark hole of the alcoholic, I hit it. I hit it in 6 years. I spiraled down, and that separation between what I want you to think I am and what I really am, that self-hatred, that I only meant to have one, waking up in places that, you know, I wasn't, they were no longer safe in my own town. And my moment of truth when it started my spiral was I was in D.C., my college, the college I went to was in D.C., and the girls all went out, and we went to a bar called The Dubliner, and right next door was the Irish Times, and my sister actually worked in the Irish Times. And I left a group that was in one bar, and I went to the other bar, and I don't know what happened. I don't know if I got locked out. I don't know what happened other than I woke up in the alley, and the sun was coming up. And I woke up to a gentleman who had stopped his car, and he's coming towards me just as I'm waking up, and I'm thinking, oh my God, he's going to shoot me. Except the fact that he had a suit on, and he was clean cut, and I'm thinking, and this is all running through my head, why would he shoot me if he's going to work? You know, like, I couldn't make sense of it, and I go to grab I'm freezing, I'm like shivering, and I can't even put a time. I'm thinking it must have been like October, November, because it was cold enough in the early morning. But I didn't have any wrap, any sweater or anything. I'm freezing. And I think when I moved, I scared him. He must have thought, you know, afterwards, I can see it now, he must have thought it was a dead body in the alley. And he's coming towards me, and I move, and we scare each other. You know, we're like, whoa! And he looked at me, and I remember the look on his face, and then my immediate shame, like, what am I doing? Like, I had to come up with a quick story, but I didn't know my story. I didn't know what I was doing there. I didn't know what to say. He simply said, are you okay? And I didn't even know if that was a yes or a no. So I said yes, and he said, do you need a ride? And my first thought was, no, thank you, like, I'm all set. But clearly I was not all set. You know, I had no shoes and no pocketbook, and I didn't even know what day it was. So he asked me where I lived, and it dawned on me at that point, I am so far away from campus, I don't have any money, and I don't know how I'm going to get back. And I said, I live, you know, I go to school, and I named the college, and then I really felt like shame. He looked at me and goes, you go there, and you're here? Like, and he said, let me take you back. And I'm thinking, I don't know if this is a good thing or not a good thing. And for a moment there, I'm thinking, I may never see anyone that I know or love again, but I have no choice. So I got in the car, and I got dropped off. It was a long ride. And he just, good luck. Hope you make it. Probably shouldn't drink like that again. And I knew what he said was all true. And I'm sleeking in the back way, and I see one of the nuns, and I'm kind of doing one of these, and I slip up into the dorm, take a shower, I hear my girlfriend's in the other room, I come out with the hair and the towel and the wrap, and I come in, and they're laughing, they're like, where were you? And I had disappeared so many times from the nights before that nobody even asked anymore, like, where were you, where'd you go, what'd you do? And you know what clicked in, that remorse and that guilt immediately went to, I got away with it. They were all going up to down in the cafeteria to eat, and I went from shame to like, huh, I got away with that, showered, dressed, and I'm off again. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, you know, maybe it wasn't so bad. Maybe I just forgot to eat before I went out drinking. And all of a sudden, the shift of, you know, he's right. I'm a loser. I probably shouldn't drink I probably just had one too many. And all of a sudden, the justification, the delusion of what could have just happened, just gone. And I'm right in the moment again, except that I'm failing out in school. You know, they're all studying all weekend. We have midterms or something, and my papers aren't written. My test scores are not great. And I'm now getting ready to cheat my way through. Like, I gotta make the grade. And it just didn't work. I get on academic probation, and I know that I know the gig is coming up. And somehow, I got a great score on an exam that I don't remember even reading the book. But somehow, my name and the score, and I didn't cheat on that one. And I skimmed by the skin of my teeth. And now that I don't go home for Christmas break, I can't deal with my parents. They don't get it. They don't understand. My mother took my fake ID. Does she not know that that's what college kids do? Don't know the angst that I must put them through. You know, I don't get the fact that I disappear, don't call home, that they don't know where I am. They know where I am. They just don't hear from me on a regular basis. And the arrogance and the self-loathing with the scheming, the lying, and the dishonesty. That's all I can say. And yet, there's a part of me that knows I'm slipping. You know, I'm slipping. It's harder to get the stories together, and it's harder to not necessarily make the grade, but not literally, but figuratively. Like, I'm trying to keep up with my peers, and it's getting harder. It's getting harder to do. My sister graduates. My sister is at this school. She, of course, is like, you know, she's on, she's not on academic probation. She's on the opposite. She's got more accolades, and they love her, and she's got all these privileges. And it's her graduation. And I know my parents are coming into town, and I try to avoid, I know her dorm, and I knew where I was, and I knew a back escape. So I start in on the back staircase. Who do I run right into but my dad? My dad looks at me and basically has that moment of truth, because I'm now like, I haven't eaten. I found speed so I can drink longer and stay up later and try to make the grade. So I'm like emaciated. And he looks, takes one look at me and says, "Are you done yet?" And those words resonated. Like, "Am I done yet?" I just looked at him, and I couldn't look down. That's all I remember. Like, I wanted to be so full of shame. And he was a lawyer that was pretty much shamed out of our town, because he spent more time defending his own family than he did, you know, other members. And I had never, that was part of my comparing out. I was never arrested. I didn't, you know, I didn't sell drugs. I didn't, wasn't disorderly. I was the good girl. And all of a sudden, his words, "Are you done yet?" I'm thinking, he knows. He knows what I'm up to. And I just looked at him and I'm like, "I need help." And he's like, "Yeah, you do. You know, we're going to pack up your sister after the ceremony, and we're taking you back to the Cape." Now, I hadn't been back to the Cape in a year. I kind of, you know, spent the previous summer working so that I looked, like, really escaped. I didn't want to hear it, is really what it boils down to. They were that, you know, the na-na, like the Charlie Brown, the teacher, rah-rah-rah. And what I didn't know is they had found Al-Anon, and they stopped that. They just started the, you know, making me responsible. Like, go figure. Like, you are responsible for your own drinking. You are responsible for your own actions. So that ride from Washington, D.C. to Massachusetts felt like weeks, not days, not hours, weeks, because there was silence the entire time. My sister, who graduated, Martha, to this day can get a zing in there, because her albums or things had to be left out of the car so that me and my few belongings could go in. And if it were up to her, she would have left me on the side of the road. I know that. And she was part of that. You know, she did it. She's shamed. She's one of them. And she's not willing to look at it. And I just remember that remorse and guilt. They talk about it in the big book. And when I read that, that's what it is. I had shamed her. I had shamed the school I belonged to. I had shamed my parents. I owed money. I was a liar, a cheater, and a thief, and I was barely alive. And they came back to the Cape, and again, as soon as I got into my environment, the same thing as the dorm room, all of a sudden my friends were like, "Yay, let's like have a few." And I started to get it up, and from that period to the next 6 months, were the longest 6 months of my life, trying to prove you're not an alcoholic. Has anyone ever tried to do that and look good on the outside and try to cover your steps? And I'm going out with this one, but trying to be back, you know, at a reasonable hour, but then just sneaking out the back door. My dad was military, World War II, and at the time I had no idea what post-traumatic stress was. So when we snuck in the middle of the night and scared the poor man half to death, and he'd jump up like he was defending the country, we'd be like, "Nah, you know, go to sleep, it's only us, it's only 9 o'clock. And you know, so we were playing off that. And I'm thinking, oh my God, we had no idea the kind of worry and, again, the stress. Because I was thinking, like, it's all about me. They're just on my case, not what they were going through. Let me speed this up a little bit into the solution, is that my brother came in, and he had spotted me and my friends out drinking, and I got caught in the lie. And basically told right out on me, and my parents looked right at him and looked at me, and he said, I'm taking her to a women's big book study, and she can find her own ride home. And again, it was one of those silent rides. I shut the door, and I came home, and I came home with one of these books, and I'm like, here I am, I'm going to give it a try. But what happened was at that meeting was there was a woman there that I partied with and who was in my high school. She was a year younger than me. And I remember seeing her. She looked fabulous. She just looked healthy and happy. And I'm thinking, I look like death warmed over. And she knew it, and I knew it, and we didn't really talk that night. So when I got back to the house, my brother said, did you see so-and-so? I couldn't retain anything. I'm like, no. He goes, yeah, you did. You were sitting next to her. He described her. I'm like, that was a female. And you know, the one with the tattoos and the, you know, the nose ring and the, you know, I thought she was like planted there as from the court system. And they're like, no, but that will be your sponsor if you can't find one. And I'm thinking, you are kidding me. I don't think you're allowed to assign sponsors. Aren't I supposed to pick them? He goes, that's your choice. Before the next meeting, you find someone you can relate to. And that woman, I called her, or she called me, actually, and asked me if I wanted a ride this time to the meeting. And long story, she was the woman who sat with me and read and showed me certain passages in this book that... when we were reading in the group and suggested I go to other meetings between the women's big book step study. So she was the one I asked those questions to, like, how did you know you were an alcoholic? And she opened it up to the page about the We Agnostics. And if you honestly want to stop drinking, find that once you've, you know, I'm going to paraphrase it, that once you put alcohol, you have little or no control over how much you drink. And I'm like, and she goes, I thought so. You know, I thought so. Perhaps you are an alcoholic, and perhaps you are suffering from spiritual illness. And I'm like, I never heard that before. And then she pointed out things like, Dr. Silkworth, maybe you just have an allergy to alcohol. Well, that was so much more, I could take that, an allergy to alcohol. I like that, actually. You know, I'm not this alcoholic failure. And so she helped explain what this book did so that it meant something to me. And I was like, I'm really having a problem with this God thing. And she goes, yep, I got it. You know, I told you, especially at the Catholic school thing, I'm like, yep, guilt, shame, remorse, he hates me, I don't deserve it, blah, blah, blah. And she said, throw it all out. Throw it out. Believe that I believe. Believe that whatever you knew me, I'm not that woman anymore. And that is the God of my understanding, and you can borrow mine. And I'm like, huh, I didn't know they were up for rent. And so she taught me that her God was loving and that I didn't have to be afraid of her God. And eventually, for lack of another word, so if I use the word God and people are offended, so is I. Like, do we have to keep talking about that three-letter word? And but once it became personal, I didn't feel so bristled by it. You know, it's like, huh, I don't know what other word to call it. And I had heard, you know, group of drunks, good orderly direction, whatever you need, just make it so it's yours and believe the coincidence. And she showed me, you know, like, don't you think it's a little odd that when you came in that I was in that room? I'm like, yeah, that's a God wink. So she started using ways to show me how God worked in my life. Well, about a year goes by, and I did get my one-year chip from her, my cake, my chip. And she didn't, I remember her saying this, she's no longer a threat to herself or others. She made it a year. And because I really had attitude, I had the, you know, stay away from me. I wanted friends, but my body language was stay away. And she taught me that... the energy was not loving, so that's why people backed away. And I probably didn't want to use the middle finger. That usually is not a good way to make friends. And that it was okay to dress like a girl again, and that not, you know, there were some circumstances where I had become really a man-hater. And not all men are horrible, but, you know, you get to have grace and dignity here. And your definition of what kind of woman you want to be is is that it says it in the book. You get to ask God to shape your morals and ideas, and that, you know, you can learn to trust that inner instinct. You can learn to trust again. And she taught me that. The biggest lesson I learned in AA was she drank again, and I didn't think it was possible. I didn't think that someone who could teach the big book like that, who knew my heart, who could teach me the path, could drink again. And it was another member of Alcoholics Anonymous who taught me the importance of remembering that we're all just trusted servants, that all of us have just one day. And this book can be memorized from cover to cover, and it can be felt in the heart, but it's only as good as the day. You know, how well you can implement it in your life. And that was one of the hardest lessons. I really had a hard time with that. And shortly after that, my mom died unexpectedly. And it was a tough place to be, because the God of my understanding was like, I wasn't ready yet. You know, I was still using hers, and hers didn't obviously work for her. But you know what? That woman that I described, who was, you know, with the nose ring there, well, she had changed. She was this soft, wonderful woman who came to my mom's wake, and so loving, so sweet, so genuine. And it was none of my friends, because I really didn't really have many. It was a lot of my brother's motorcycle friends that called themselves the fifth chapter. And they traveled in a pack, and they were so wonderful to come in. My dad was really dying of a broken heart. I mean, he had really been the Archie Bunker to my mom, and he was so full of remorse and guilt for, you know, my mom suffered from diabetes, and she had slowed down quite a bit. And he, in his love for her and his inability for words, he was like Archie Bunker. He would, you know, say things that weren't really nice. And all of a sudden, her death, he was just overcome with guilt and remorse. And you know, we were an alcoholic family that was still broken. Really, we were still, you know. Some were still drinking, some were still going to AA, but this group, this fifth chapter, was the name of the men's part of the men's big book. They came in and kind of did, from soup to nuts, ran, you know, an after funeral, and one of the women said, I know you really miss Donna, but we really miss you, and you can't fix her, but you can change your path by coming back. And I did. You know, I kind of came back for about another year. And long story short is that I met a man who I worked with, and he was also in the program. And I thought, because he had 9 years, that he walked on water. Long and short of it is, he was not a big book person. He was not really, you know, into the steps that much, and he didn't drink and had a great spiritual program. I'm like, that is so much easier than all the work these guys want me to do. And I'm like, I'm supposed to, like, do a 10-step inventory and look at where I'm still self-centered and self-absorbed and ask for corrective measures. And quite frankly, you don't have to do that, and that's really great. So we started hanging out. And again, you know, although I never picked up, there was a part of me that kind of settled for less in this program. And you can do that. And I hung there for a long time. Actually, we got married and had 3 children. And I stayed in that marriage for many years. And we did move, and I did get involved in a big book meeting. It's still, you know, the heart of my program. But there were a lot more like steps, and there are different types of meetings. And I was always active. I always had a service position. But I never felt like that same kind of connect as I did with that first group of women who really saved my life. And here I am, you know, I'm a sober mom, and I'm, you know, PTA and carpools and the whole bit. And there was a part of me that I had to learn to keep my program fresh for me and stop taking the inventories of other people. And, you know, my husband at the time was not one that would talk about the steps. Actually, the only inventory we ever took was Justine's, and I was okay with that for a while, that self-hatred. You know, it must be me, it must be me. And some of the illness kind of grew under our house. But because our kids were well-behaved and good kids and we showed up at church, that even people in our group thought, like, they're the perfect couple. And they didn't know some of the twists that had never been untwisted. You know, they talk about the program, the inability to have another healthy relationship with another human being. I'm here to tell you that after 27 years of marriage, I have to tell you I never really knew him. He wouldn't let me. And any time I did, it must be my fault. And I fed into that for a long time. And I had women in my Mary D. who saw it and could only go so far because I was so defensive, you know. And but you don't understand. And she watched the sickness continue even though I was sober and didn't drink. And long and short of it is my first son, I'd love to tell you, I took a lot of credit for it, but I didn't. That was God. He was a pre-programmed happy child who just knew what to do. The second child was Mini-Me, and he was, you know, in the high chair. You knew that there was a problem. As you know, he didn't get his own way. Something got flung. And, you know, stomping his hands, me, 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 me. That child grew up, and at 13, he came to me and said, I found a joint in Dad's car. And I had to say, my definition of sobriety, honey, is that no alcohol, no mind-altering substance. All I can tell you is that is not mine. And hence began some of the twisted behaviors of what one would define sobriety. And I knew that my son heard his dad's answer, and then within a very short period of time started smoking pot himself. And I saw the alcohol pick up, and I remembered very quickly exactly how Justine was when she started. It was party till you drop, blackout drinker, and this kid that was an incredible little golfer could care less. The next thing you know, his hand is broken, his face is all beat up, he's got a mouth on him. I'm like, oh my God, I know that look, I know that sound, I know that what alcohol does. And my daughter at the time was this little sweet little ballerina, so I'm running to ballet class with her, stitching up her toe shoes while yelling at the other one who's got now probation, you know, because he got arrested at doing something, you know, one of those pranks that sounded like a good idea at the time, and it wasn't. And it began a path that was so hard, and all of a sudden I realized, you know, what my parents had gone through, and now my parents were both gone. And the amends was the living amends, going, oh my God, you know, I can't get into it. I living with an active alcoholic child was probably some tough years. You know, really tough years, because you want to believe there's nothing wrong, and you want to believe that this disease is not hereditary. You want to believe that they, you know, they're going to grow out of it. And at the same time, I'm watching the progression. You know, the justifications, the low self-esteem, the lying, the catching, and what happened was I jumped into AA, and I jumped into it. I actually had never left, but my heart jumped back into it. Let's put it that way. The words began to jump back out at the page, and I am so grateful because I have seen people here after a certain amount of years where it does get old and discontent, and you're like, I know the book, I know it, I know it. The bottom line is if the heart doesn't feel it and the head doesn't feel it and you're not acting it, there's the door, there's the bottle. And what happened was Grace, my little ballerina, was diagnosed with some medical condition that if you get on the internet, you're like, oh God, that is not fair. That is so not fair. She is my reason to live. She's my reason to laugh. Bottom line was, because I jumped back in, because I went and, you know, realized that this alcoholic person still had that crazy mind, I just didn't pick up. And a year later, my son that was a mini-me was killed in a car wreck. And the people, just like they had from my mom's funeral, came out of the woodwork. The girls that I had, you know, I didn't even remember doing a commitment in one of the rehabs, were like, you were there for me. I don't even remember their names. You know, I just did the footwork, and all of a sudden, I'm receiving their love. One of the kids in my home group, It was just, he had a mouth on him. The F word was every other word. And I remember thinking, well, he just stopped swearing and just jump into the Lord's Prayer. And is he ever going to get it? He was the one who was the EMT the night of the accident. And he tried to explain, you know, some of the medical terms. I'm like, Tommy, not now. And I knew that at the funeral, I could smell alcohol in his breath. And he's looking at me like, how are you sober? And I was like, I don't know, you know, the grace of God. And what I knew the first day that I walked in here, it's not an option for me. That was dragged into my head. You don't get to drink, you know, no matter what. But I didn't think no matter what meant the hardest days. But you know what? During Preston's death, I never thought of drinking. And yet I'm watching this kid Tommy from my home group not getting it. And although he stopped swearing, I can smell alcohol in his breath. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh. Fast forward a year later after Preston's death, I'm still doing the chips and I call out the chips. And again, I'm you know, it's a year anniversary, you're just you know, life goes on. And I see these black shoes coming up. And I look up, and it's Tom. He's picking up his one-year chip. And I'm thinking, oh, my God. Like, it was the most incredible gift. One child dies from this disease, and another one picks up his one-year chip. And I'm thinking, we don't get to pick the chairs next to us. We don't get to pick who makes it, who doesn't. We don't get to pick, you know, how they do it, when they do it, what their God is, who takes it, how they do it. The bottom line is the only one I can ever, the only sobriety that matters to me to keep on path with the God of my understanding is mine. And the only way I know how to keep it is to give it away by my experience, not by my opinion. And although that marriage was doomed to fail from start. And I have to go back and tell, you know, some of the girls that the work in the fourth step, when it asks you to do an inventory, it is not what you want to be. It's what, who and what you are. And that whole piece of the work that I thought I had done, I still picked an emotionally unavailable person. And although it was part of that whole dynamics, I never drank. It was only at Preston's death when I couldn't fix it anymore. And other things happened that I could no longer fix an unfixable situation, and I could no longer accept an unacceptable behavior. And when I left Massachusetts, it was for a job down here. It was in a... I really had no... I didn't know what I was doing here, quite frankly. The... economic situation that was so bad in Massachusetts. And to back up, I never finished that degree at that school. What I did do is I was a stay-at-home mom for about 2 years, and I jumped back into part-time work at a bank and started collecting certifications and different financial pieces that at the time would give you the experience in the field. And the bottom line was the banks were all merging, and you know, the people were being laid off left and right, and the writing was on the wall. I was in getting the work of other people and not getting paid for it because I really didn't have, you know, six letters behind my name. And so two or three different attempts for promotion were denied. And so I put my application in to a woman that I knew that was down in Virginia. And she said, I'm not only going to take you, I'm going to raise your salary by quite a bit, quite enough to make the trip. And then she said, let's do a temporary. And when I got there and started working, and, you know, the 90-day review was up, she said, we want to keep you on, and it's not because you're a number cruncher or you're so brilliant in finance. It's because you bring to this company, and she described the AA program. You bring balance, you bring honesty, you bring integrity, you bring to the table things that we can't get from our students who come out of some of these schools. We need that balance. We are a company that's just... we've got the best of the best, but they're killing each other here, you know, and they've got the elbow going and the stress going. You bring She didn't use the word God, but we both knew what she was talking about. And I stayed here, and I went through that divorce and went through some financial horrible stuff as a result. And I was ready to, I wasn't really ready to date at all. As a matter of fact, I found a friend who both moved at the same time, and I was a gardener and a hiker, and I loved the zest for life, and I'm doing that to keep myself from feeling, you know, less than, lonely, made a mistake, however you want. I'm following that path of the high of my higher power, and this person is part of my life all of a sudden. And that honesty and trust as a friend was there, and it changed from a friendship into a dating situation. And that man is now my husband. And I never knew it was possible that I could have a best friend to be married to him, because I never had that. And we don't have children together. Our children are grown. And as a matter of fact, my daughter called today just before Rick left for work, and she's trying to buy a mattress. She graduated from college, and she's got some financial situations. She's got some student loans, and she's trying to figure out her budget and could she afford a mattress. Well, I'm like, you know, she was driving me crazy. You know how your daughter, you're like, you were going over the same thing over and over and over again. And I'm just hand the phone to Rick. I'm like, tell this story to Rick. And they solved the issue. Go here and ask for this and certain price, boom, 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 boom. I'm like, so logical with her, you know, like you make so much sense. And you know what? I heard from my brother today. I heard from one of my sisters. I will have a conversation with my son. My oldest son is 30, and the joys of living. The joys of living is that child at 19 lost his best friend, his brother, when he was killed. And that boy, Harry, at 19, felt as though it was his fault. So when we lose people in this program and we think that we're not hurting anyone, watching that kid at 19 can't come home because of the memories that somehow he let his little brother down. And I'm like, Harry, you didn't kill your brother. Your brother was an alcoholic. Your brother drank. Your brother snuck out of the house. He took your car and totaled it and killed himself while doing it. I said, you didn't cause it. You can't fix it. And that boy grew up to be the most incredible man, married the most incredible woman. I can't believe she's my daughter-in-law. And she's just wonderful. This past, in 2015, we watched them get married, and I walked down, was introduced with my ex-husband, because we are still our children's parents. And Rick, during the church, I had Rick on one side, my ex-husband on the other, and we're all okay with this. And watched these two people profess their love in a way that was just magical for me. And what, I mean, talk about a God wink. The house was rented by her family, and this is where they came from, Upper State, New York. They had no idea what they were doing. They rented a house, and the cross street was Preston Lane. Which was, and when we saw that, everyone just was like, oh my God, that's a God wink. You know, we can now recognize that in our life, and Preston was very much a part of that day. My daughter graduated and got a job, and I'm so proud of herself, because when I moved down here, we talk about the inventory, the biggest fear. You know, I had to redo a fourth step after that divorce, and in my fear column, my fear was I'd lose another kid. And when she was not doing well in one school and feeling like a failure, she called me up and she said, I wanted to take my car and put it in front of a truck. And I knew what that felt like. And I'm thinking, this kid isn't drinking yet, but I carry the gene. This kid is the most incredible kid, the ballerina that, you know, that was my joy. And all of a sudden, I'm down here and I almost bolted. And I said, what is it that you need? And she said, I need God and I need to change schools. And I'm like, then you do it, girl. I don't care. All I could think of was the cost of, you know, rehabs and the cost of, you know, funerals. We've already done that. Go to school and we'll figure it out. And she did. She figured it out. And she's not one of us. As a matter of fact, her tales I don't get. Like, Mom, I had three drinks and I didn't like the feeling, so I came home. I'm like, okay, you know. You know, she's like, Mom, I smoked pot. There must have been something in it. I took a bucket of water and I threw it over my head. I'm like, weird, but okay. You know, I don't get that. I don't get that kind of drinking. She was one that at 12. She was 12 when Preston died, and she would she laid in bed and cried for about 3 months straight, every night. We were trying to put our family together, and I could hear her sobbing. And finally, I went in there, I'm like, what are you crying about? And she said, do you know what the last thing I said to my brother? I said, nope. She said, he was just so horrible. She said, he was trying to take my money when we were heading out of town, and I had, you know, I had my money in my piggy bank, and I told him to shut up, and then I hated him, and I wish he would just go away. I'm like, you didn't kill him, honey. Preston was an alcoholic. He wanted your money. He was, at least he asked you. I used to steal mine. So we sat up and shared. I said, you know what I used to think? I said, Grace, he was my son. And there were times that I loved him as my son. And I hate the disease of alcoholism. It was killing him. It was killing us. He would have stole your money. And I said, you know, not that those are not nice words, but you didn't kill him. And here she is just on top of the world. And well, I'm not going to cry, but she did say whenever she got scared, it was like, I can't face this one more test or one more obstacle. She said, I used to think of like Preston looking down at me going, you can do it. You can do it. And alcoholism destroyed our family, my childhood family growing up. And my mother died with half her kids sober. And I almost had to say no to Billy because I have a sister-in-law coming up from Florida who will be staying at the house. She did postpone it a week. She lost my niece 5 years ago from a heroin overdose. And there was only 6 grandchildren, and 2 of them are dead. You know, one died, you know, in a car crash. The other one overdosed. So that our family shows the signs of this disease. And we talk about it, and my daughter, I'm going to close really with this because it encapsulates the recovery piece. She and her moving around and in schools, she was her roommate was assigned to her, and she recognized a book, a little 24-hour book next to this girl's bed. And one day the girl was crying and looked like hell, and my daughter says, did you drink last night? And she goes, how'd you know? She goes, I know the book. Get on your knees, ask for help, and call your sponsor and cut the crap. You know? And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you know, who knew, you know, that this girl, and that girl is sober today. That was about 2.5 years ago. And for a while, I'd get a text from like, she's driving me crazy. I'm like, just you need a meeting. You know, go to Al-Anon, pick up an Al-Anon book, do whatever. But just the fact of how the God winks, that, you know, that are a mosaic in our life, you know, puzzles that are put together. I moved to Virginia 5 years ago, and I love it here. I feel like it's home. The hardest part is that I had to give up my my support systems, my home group, people who were there for me in several areas. You know, the Cape is pretty small, and I had people that from my high school, you know, that we were sober to. We drank together, and we met up in sobriety. And then my home group. And I have a woman named Linda F. who is, you know, walked this path with her for 30 years, and we've raised our children together. And she'll be making a trip down here in the spring. And the truth of the matter is I have a home group, and I didn't say that when I first started today. My home group is Saturday mornings at 7 o'clock, and we do this book. We study this book. And the home group members are like family members to me. I feel like on Saturday morning I'm given the gift that I get to go greet them and have coffee with them and hug them and say thank you for being part of my life. And there's Greg H., you know, I call him my sober brother. I had sober brothers when I got in this room, and they're the ones who told me how things really were. You know, like, you're being a little bit of a witch, you know. How's your program going? You know, and my sober brothers don't have to say that now. They can greet me and say thank you. But I did text him. I wasn't in my home group yesterday, and for good reasons. Rick and I went down to Busch Gardens and did a celebration of, you know, the Festival of Lights down there. And it was kind of unexpected. But I care enough about my home group members to let them know where I am. I'm fine. I'm safe. It's good. I'm celebrating life. And that's my core. So if anyone doesn't have a home group, this is a great one. This is a really powerful one, and I love to see the interactions. And that's what made me feel at home, you know, to watch the people come together, because I want to be in. I want to I want to live. And when I first came, my moment of truth was I didn't know if I wanted to live or I wanted to die. And I'm so grateful that I wanted to live, one. And today I am just exploding with enthusiasm. I love this program almost to a fault because I get so excited when I see someone come in that I have to remember that I'm not God. And I don't know if they get to stay. But I know that if I do what I do today, what I did yesterday, the chances are I'm going to stay sober one more day. Thanks.